I have no plan for it. I just want to get out there, and the ego in me would love to have that out there. And it's done now. And it is something I'm proud of, even though I know there's a missing full stop. But
as a business owner, you'll know you either need to hire a writer or become a writer. Welcome to the show where you'll hear conversations covering everything you need to know about writing for and about your business. Hello and welcome back to the Let's Talk Writing podcast. I'm excited to bring to you today a colleague of mine from Swansea University, Geraint Brown. Geraint is the coordinator of English for Specific Purposes and a tutor of English for Academic Purposes at Swansea University and the author of Problem Questions for Law Students. He specialises in developing, teaching and delivering medical English, English for Sports, English for Academics, English for International Lecturers in the UK and, of course, Legal English. He's a chair and panel member of the Academic Integrity Committee at Swansea University and a fellow of the Higher Education Academy. I wanted to have Geraint on to talk about traditionally publishing a book from your course. And as you'll hear in the conversation, Geraint didn't have a massive author platform, but there was a clear audience, a market case for the book, and Geraint was the obvious person to write the book because of his experience and expertise. So if you've ever thought about publishing a book from your course and would like to get it traditionally published, then take a listen. Welcome to the show, Geraint. Pleased to have you on.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
If you could start off by just telling us what your book's about and who it's for, first of all.
Okay, well, the book is called Problem Questions for Law Students. Hopefully trying to make it as simple as possible, but essentially it stemmed from a new question type that I was trying to introduce onto a law course, so called a problem question. So your typical essay question at university will be like, to what extent is this, or critically evaluate this case or this constitution, or variations on that. But the problem question is where you give students a scenario, essentially. And from that scenario, they have to follow certain steps and then come to their own conclusion about whether there is a case to answer, whether somebody had would be found guilty or not guilty, what are the defences, those sort of things. So it's basically looking at a little bit more authentic assessment that you'd expect a lawyer to do when they were in post. So it's aimed at undergraduates and postgraduates. And the cohort that I tend to teach are mostly internationals where English isn't their first language. So there's a lot of elements here about not just teaching your legal English and your academic style, your academic register and format. So what this book is trying to do is give a step-by-step method, if you like, of
how to
approach these questions. So it's not really just international students. This is what I discovered. It was all students. So it's students that finish their A-levels where they have a type of problem question. But this isn't homogenous across all A-level qualifications. So your WJEC qualification at A-level, for example, will have a type of problem question. But if you're looking at, I don't know, EdXL or maybe a Scottish equivalent, they may or may not use problem questions so frequently.
Okay, so that's interesting. So just I've got a lot of international listeners who aren't necessarily familiar with the English, British and Welsh education systems. So yeah, those are just the UK education school leaving exams are A-level. So yeah, that's really interesting. And it's interesting that you wrote it for a really specific niche, which was the internationals, but have actually found that it is useful for a broader audience than that. And I think that's a really good example of kind of, you know, finding your ideal reader, first of all, and then it will be relevant for more people as well.
And from that, it was just a complete matter of timing, but the lawyers entry exam, so if you want to become a solicitor in the UK around about the time of writing this, so I would say 2020, 2021, that neck of the woods, there was talk about them changing the entrance exam or the qualification to the SQE, the Solicitor's Qualifying Exam. This was a whole new assessment. Anyone that qualifies with an LLB or an LLM now, a master's or an undergraduate in law, if they want to be a practicing solicitor, they now have to sit the SQE. And at the time, it was like, we're going to do a new exam. And it was just trying to find information about what this exam was going to look like. And the smarter what later, the publishers were quite keen on me including information on this.
But oh, great. Yeah.
It was so little information. Like, there was just, we're testing this at the moment. So is this going to be the way that we're going to do it? It's just an idea. You know, is the assessment valid? And all these different questions about the SQE. So it spans everything from A-level, your undergraduate degree, your postgraduate degree, and then your post-qualification degree, if you like.
Oh, yeah, interesting. Okay, so Garrett, what made you want to write a book?
Well, in September 2019, I just finished teaching the law course for the on the pre-sessional. And I realised that the assessments we were giving our students weren't really suitable for what they were going on to do. So one of my core beliefs is that assessment needs to be as authentic as possible. Mm. I'm a fan of making what I call synthetic material, which is where I base what students will be doing in their future careers and trying to adapt that material. So basically, like, drip feeding or spoon feeding, you know, the steps, so they're becoming more familiar, more skilled with what they're doing. So I wanted to create that different type of assessment for my students. So as I said, you know, the typical essay wasn't really passing mustard with a group. Mm-hmm. So based on that, September 19, so I started to write a new course curriculum and just sort of spanning ideas. And then I found out that the law course wasn't going to be a standalone course anymore. So it was going to be integrated into a larger course. And for reasons I won't go into here, but much to my aggravation. So I had a very clear idea and something that I really believed in that I thought was going to be really, really beneficial for the students. So by maybe, I don't know, the end of the year, so December 2019, I'd just been chipping away at all this material and I had quite a good bank of material that I was just going to use for the next year's pre-sessional. And there it was, not being used. So I thought, what can I do with it? And then it was a chance meeting with a law professor who said, do you know what you want? I told him about the course not being standalone for 2020. And he said, oh, you want to turn that into a book?
Mm.
And I'd never considered it before. I think I'd had the thought of putting it as a MOOC, you know, a massive open-ended course for online. But I hadn't actually thought about putting it in paper. So that was the eye-opener. And basically it stems from then.
Okay, great. So is it kind of coming up with something that there was a real need for this? In other words, and you know, that law professor could see that. So
I believe so. And it was strange. It was him that had seen the materials and knew what I was doing. It was him who said, look, you know, be proactive, believe in yourself, you can do this.
Yeah, I think sometimes it just takes someone else to kind of, you know, for them to see that something in us that we might not necessarily see ourselves, isn't it?
So. Absolutely. And I tell you what, anyone listening who's thinking about doing a book, you will get imposter syndrome. You will think, what am I doing?
Yeah.
How am I possibly qualified to do this? And even now, some days I'll pick it up and I have a look. And I'll go, I can't believe I wrote that. That's brilliant. There's something in there that really, really, Also, I'll get days where I look at that and I go, how would I do that different? I would do it different. I don't know how. What a fraud I am. Honestly, you'll go through these two extremes of utter highs and the that's despair. But, you know, you will very much have imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
I think that's, for me, that's speak for myself. I think that's quite a normal feeling.
I think so. Oh, for me, absolutely. And any, you know, all of the students and clients I work with, everything, everyone feels like that. And the other thing is as well, that when you start writing something, you're not necessarily, like, you were obviously an expert in that because you've been teaching it, but you're not as much of an expert as you're going to be by the time you finish doing all the extra research that it takes to put a book together and thinking about it in that form. I don't know if you'd agree with that. That brings a whole nother level of expertise just going through that process and, you know, making sure you've got everything in there. And
yeah, you've got to make sure that everything that you're writing is correct. And, you know, we can put our own, I suppose it's my opinion as how you could best create this. And I've tried to scaffold some learning in it. And that's what I would have done in the classroom. So somebody else who's another EAP practitioner could well come up and say, do you know, your methodology is completely wrong or it's unsuitable. Why don't you do it this way? So, you know, that's me putting myself out there, exposing myself to the world. Yeah. And this is what I'm doing. And it's scary.
You know, it absolutely is. Anything you put down and put out into the world is scary. But, you know, we need people to do that, don't we? If you've got that expertise, and it can obviously help all these struggling students that are coming to write their law essays and can use your book. So
I think to anyone who's in that situation, I wouldn't be scared because, you know, we're such a nice collegiate community that I don't think any EAP practitioner would come up and say, you know, Geraint, what a pile of rubbish you've written. Everyone is really supportive that I've heard from. That's nice, you know, where people see value in what you've done, and people said, you know, what the way that you've approached that is very different to how I would have done it. And that, you know, when you go on a teaching observation, you see one of your colleagues working, and you see, oh, I wouldn't have done that way. So it's quite refreshing, I think, that people have seen this and they go, all right, so that's how you would have done that. I quite like that idea, or I've seen your idea, but you've missed the trick here. I'm going to adapt it and make it my own.
Yeah, so, which is what it's all about. Yeah. And we all do it differently, don't we? And there's a teacher for everyone, you know, someone that might like the way that I teach or you teach might not get on with the way that someone else is teaching. Yeah. So I think there's room for everyone.
And these books, study guides, aren't the golden bullet. You know, they're not the panacea where there is an answer for everyone. This is basically just me showing the doors and one approach or a couple of approaches. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So yeah, there's, you know, inside the book, I was quite aware of this, and that's where I've done different activities for different levels. So there's like somebody who's approaching, let's say you're a QAT student, you've got a very different legal system, and you're not aware about how things work in the UK, or you're an A-level student. The task that I've given you there is very different, with the same learning point as to whether you're going into your master's where you will have done 3 years of law, all
yes.
right?
Yeah.
So that was quite nice, and something that a lot of feedback was quite positive about is the way that I'd seen there was such a range of people, and it's trying to be visible to all of them.
Yeah,
so everyone can gain.
Okay, so something I wanted to ask you about, because it might be relevant to a lot of listeners who are teaching courses and things, how easy was it to adapt your existing course material into the book? And was it quite straightforward, or did you need to change a lot of things?
The course is a bit different from my situation because I found out that it wasn't going to go ahead for the summer of 2020. So I did have one eye on making it available for MOOCs and online courses. So the biggest point, I think, was that some of the activities that I put weren't going to be as suitable on paper as they would have been had they been computerized. So, for example, you know, a drag and drop exercise, you just can't do that on pen and paper. So I was consciously trying to make as many different question types. So things like, you know, a computer will automatically mark and give you feedback on a like an end of chapter quiz. With a book, that doesn't happen. So you need an answer pages at the back.
Right, yes, yes.
Different things like this I have to be aware of. Of course, back in 2020, we were starting to get used to our new, getting used to living with COVID. So everything was massively moved towards, you know, online learning. Quizlets, you know, Canvas quizzes, all this sort of stuff. So I remember feeling quite... what's the word I'm looking for? Quite behind the times. A bit like a dinosaur, thinking about these books were going to be all about pen and paper rather than anything online. So just felt a little bit old from that. So I was aware of that. On a practical side, something that I wasn't quite aware of was that with a book, you will get your, you type it up on A4, but the page that's published isn't A4 size. Size paper. So you might have it formatted beautifully on your computer screen, but when you get a question which finishes halfway down on page 32, it looks not as you intended in your mind. So the amount of time I wasted making things look pretty on the screen.
That's so true, isn't it?
Yes. Just get the material, get the content.
Yeah, it's the content, isn't it? Yeah, and you can let important. The publisher worry about the formatting and all of that. Okay, so something I wanted to ask you about as well is the publishing process. Now, you traditionally published. Could you remind me who your publisher was again, Geraint?
Routledge.
Okay. So, yeah, how did that all come about? How did you find your publisher? And just anything about the practicalities of working with a traditional publisher that you think might be useful for listeners who are thinking about something similar.
Has anyone ever had an extension on their house built? Well, basically, you're there waiting for ages and ages for something to happen and nothing happens. And all of a sudden, you've got like walls and you're thinking, how the hell has this all come about so quickly? So it's a bit like that with that I found. You know, you're waiting for months for some communication and all of a sudden it's like, great, you've been approved, the reviewers like you, here are their suggestions, here's a contract, and you've got 7 months to finish the first draft by. So it is very much like that. It's very much stop-start. If you are in negotiations with people, then I would definitely say keep writing, because otherwise, if you're waiting for them to hear back, you know, that's only one publisher. There's no harm in approaching another one. And if you know, you're further down the line in the progress of your book, great. I think a big thing as well is not just looking at your audience, but think about the purpose of your writing yourself. So I wanted to go down the a known publisher's route purely because of the academic, kudos. Mm-hmm. And you know, the validity that it would give me as an academic and going forward. So I thought that would be quite a good thing for it. If I was going to do something separately and, you know, Bradley said, oh, no, thank you, and I wasn't having luck with any other publishers, I'd have probably gone down the self-published route. And if you look at, legal problem questions on any bookstore, particularly Amazon, you'll see, I think there's two or three which are self-published.
Okay.
And you can tell. I've not looked at the other people. I think there's about another two books there. I've not looked at them, so I couldn't comment. But just looking at it from a face value thing, when you've got something which is a tenor, which is written by somebody who you don't know, even though they might have the same credentials as me, versus one that's gone through the whole reviewing process and it's been proofread and it's got someone's rubber stamped it and said, this is of a good quality, then I think that's important.
I think particularly in for your particular kind of academic context, but what I would say for kind of not to put people off if they do want to publish something and self-publishing it, is to make sure you just have all the same quality control processes in place that you would if you were traditionally publishing, I think is the key there. You know, all the different number of edits you go for, the different types of edits, the proofreading, and it's to have all that, because, you know, there's no same. I've read plenty of self-published books, which I just think, yeah, I can tell they haven't had it proofread. But on the other hand, I've read some really great stuff, which has a really good quality. So I think it's making sure you kind of achieve that quality. Yeah, but I can totally understand wanting to have the rubber stamp of a top publisher behind you for, you know, your academic context.
And what I would say that the, you know, you're getting much less money back in terms of the royalties.
Yes.
But
Yes, we had this discussion a couple of days ago, didn't we? We both had our royalty checks for the, you know, and it's, I think if you were self-publishing, you'd see a lot more of that money.
Yeah, absolutely. But what now, in reflection, I see what Routledge do. And once the whole manuscript was sent off, which I think they gave me the deadline, I think it was the 31st of December. And I remember sending it off in the wee hours of the 31st. So I wanted to get it done on the 30th, but I got it shortly after. But sending that in, and then you start the whole proofreading process and the whole copy editing and the amount of detail. And they have full-time staff whose job it is to read a book, and they understand your book. And the detail that my lady went through, I wish I could remember her name, but wow. Mm. You know, you're looking at each thing going, oh, you know, can you just check that this is the same meaning as what you said on page 192?
Yeah. It's incredible, isn't it, to have that. It helps with the confidence for putting it out there when you know someone has been through it with a fine-tooth comb like that.
Yeah. And if anyone fancies a challenge, there is one section of my book is on referencing and all about how you have to be accurate when you're doing OSCLR. So if anyone wants a challenge, there is one misplaced full stop.
Oh, love it.
There is. I found it as an error.
Oh.
So when the second edition comes out.
Yeah, that's it. Certainly for the second edition. Yeah.
Yeah, answer on a postcard, please.
Okay, so I think you've kind of answered this, but how long was the process from idea to publication, from that conversation with the professor who said, oh, you should write a book on this, to actually getting that book out in the world? How long was that, Gary?
I'm going to say it's about 2 years.
Okay.
It was, first communication with Routledge was February 2020. I sent the form off, so just basically what I think the book was about, who's the audience. They're actually quite similar to your questions now, who's your audience, you know, and what's your target, what's there in the market at the moment. So I'm just trying to, you know, create the USP for yourself. So that was sent in March 2020.
Okay.
And I didn't hear anything then until August 2020. And that's when the reviewers came back. And so, you know, that took, I don't know, was that 5 months for six people to review and send it back. As I said, I just kept on writing because I didn't know how successful it's going to be. I think I had about a chapter at that side at that stage. So about a quarter of the book. So it's about four chapters. Five out of the six came back. Liking it. Three said it was great. Two said it was good, and one said it was bloody awful. And that was interesting. The one person who said it was awful was a Russell Group lecturer professor, and he really didn't understand the concept of international students come in and not having a grasp of English and not using. Or it could have been that maybe his assessment only used typical essays. He didn't use,
it may
be more theoretical law rather than practical.
Yeah.
Just interesting that me reading his comments, her comments, I was able to go, but you've completely misunderstood the purpose.
Yeah.
But anyway, for five out of six to come back favourably,
That's brilliant. That's fantastic.
That was August. And I think shortly after that, the contract came through and they said, all right, can you get it done by, would have been December.
Okay.
So, great. Yeah.
So it's quite a quick turnaround then, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And has anything changed for you since writing the book? If you say in terms of your work or your career path or anything like that?
I don't know whether it's deliberate. I think it's just one of these sort of accidental, incidental type of things. So I was asked to be a guest expert on BBC Learning English.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, again, for international students.
Yeah, fantastic opportunity,
I've been asked to review legal English materials on a website called Cartha, which is a maritime English MOOC.
Okay.
The book's been reviewed in the Journal of English for Academic Purposes. So that was quite nice.
Yeah.
I've also been asked to appear on this podcast. So it's I'm not sure whether those have directly, apart from the book review, whether these have come directly as a result of the book I'm guessing with Carter, yes, as well. But, you know, BBC Learning English and this one, I'm not so sure, but it maybe just gives me a little bit more, a little bit more weight in what I'm saying has got a little bit of value.
So, yeah, yeah.
In terms of career path, not yet, but it's certainly opened my eyes up.
Yes. Which,
small accidental, incidental things that happen. And I have no plan for it. I just want to get out there, and the ego in me would love to have that out there. And it's done now.
Yeah, so, yeah.
And no one can take it away.
Yeah.
No, yeah. And it is something I'm proud of, even though I know there's a missing full stop. But
I think that's the quote for this episode. I'm proud of it. You know, there's a missing full stop. Love it. Okay. So which book would you write next? Would you write another book, Garrett?
It's a long, hard slog. And if you're dedicated, I would. And interestingly, this is, I suppose, another question about where getting published, what doors does it open? It's actually my sister's boyfriend is a lecturer in a different university in psychology. And we talk shop sometimes, and it's his assessment is they sometimes use something called a vignette, which is essentially the psychology or medical equivalent of a problem question. So I've said to him, look, borrow the format, change the questions into things which are more relevant to psychology. Mm-hmm. And then maybe that could be a second book. I mean, that would be co-authored, which is fine. But, you know, essentially what I've done, I've got the contact. They've got the record of how well it's doing. He's, again, a legitimate source and can use some of the information from me as a teacher, but him as a psychologist.
Yeah, yeah.
So maybe that's another way that is benefiting, is that this collaboration.
Yeah, yeah.
There would be some more work to do. So that's maybe one thing I would be interested in. But also now, I suppose, if I was going to do any sort of journal articles, then people can do a search of me and go, oh, right, okay, so he's obviously done something. It's getting that ball rolling in academia, isn't it? It's like once, you know, getting your first book or your first publication is the hardest thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So that you've got some sort of track record.
Okay, so it wouldn't put you off doing it again, then. That's good to hear. What would you recommend to any listeners who might be, you know, they're teaching something and they're thinking about turning their course or their knowledge into some kind of educational book and they want to traditionally publish?
I suggest actually that they look at e-learning. So I think either look at things like Udemy or Coursera to see what's out there at the moment. And the people who make these videos, some are very, very good. Others are people who have done something and are just reteaching, regurgitating what they've taught, what they've learned. So rather than traditionally publish, I mean, it's a slow burn. It's a long, long time. And for you to adapt materials takes a lot of time, a lot of effort. Then maybe have a look and see what's existing at the moment on those two websites. I'm sure there's others that I'm not aware of. But have a look at those two. So I was only able to find one who did something on problem questions. And yeah, I thought she did a good job. But it wasn't good enough. You know, it wasn't been how I would approach it. It was very much, this is what I'm going to tell you, now practice.
Mm.
You know, I thought that she missed a lot of tricks, and that's what I tried to do. So an existing course, I'd also say be aware of any conflict of interest. So I was aware that my course was going to be disbanded, so there wouldn't be a law course, so I'd have nowhere to have these materials. And the amount of time I spent, my hourly rate, I don't know if you'd agree, Lizzie, but my hourly rate for writing the book is awful. It's way below minimum wage, put it that way.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, you don't do it for the money. You know, Lizzie and I aren't going to become J.K. Rowling, I don't think. So, be aware of any sort of conflict of interests. Traditionally published, if it is for academia, then I would probably suggest going down the known publisher route rather than self-publishing. But keep the self-publish in your back pocket, because you don't know what's, you know, whether the publishers aren't going to understand what you're needing, or things change. You know, we're we're in this post-COVID world and getting used to things, and with the new assessment questions coming in with generative AI and ChatGPT, all that sort of stuff, it's really drawing things like assessment, which is my bag, bringing things into question. So things are also quite time limited. So, you know, we had a new release of ChatGPT in the past, well, when was it? Middle of March, I think. So we're still in HE and education trying to understand what the ramifications are of this. But definitely keep at it.
Okay, great. Well, thank you. And something I ask all my guests, what book are you currently reading, or is there a book that you'd recommend to listeners?
The irony of this, Lizzie, is that I actually don't enjoy reading for fun. I read knowledge. I read because I want to learn something. I don't read to relax. I do have a couple of books that I do, like a staple genre for when I go on holiday. And I do love books like Bravo to Zero. So anything where there's SAS, escaping.
Okay, yeah.
I'm just looking around my room at the moment now. My one book I do very much enjoy is My Shit Life So Far by Frankie Boyle.
That's not what I've read. We'll have to link to that one in the show. Okay. Oh, well, thank you so much, Geraint. Where can listeners find you or connect with you?
Oh, I'm available on LinkedIn, Geraint Stockbrown, so G-E-R-A-I-N-T.
Great. Okay. Well, thank you very much. And we'll put all the links in the show notes and link to your book, of course, there as well.
Oh, thanks, Lizzie.
If you need more help with your writing, head on over to my website, lizzietangier.com, where you can find a ton of resources to help you. There's a free author workbook to help you decide which book to write and focus your ideas, along with daily email guidance from me for a week as you work through the questions in the workbook. You'll also find links to everything mentioned on this show in the show notes.